from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. Yes, that's right. It means Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, is filling in for Tony Perkins. So much to discuss, as there always is. But we start with this story. Trump's time in the White House has been a blessing to African Americans on many levels, despite claims of racism. But you would not know it listening to the mainstream media. Ken Blackwell, Family Research Council's Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, will join me in just a moment to talk about his op-ed in USA Today. In my second segment, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has proposed regulations to punish and silence faith-based counselors who offer to help patients wanting to overcome their undesired same-sex attraction. Plus, the Democrats quietly passed reparations for homosexuals in the House. I'll talk with FRC's Peter Sprigg. At the bottom of the hour, a top Navy SEAL commandant warns other commanders of order and discipline problems within the SEALs. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, a Washington, D.C.-based national security and foreign policy analyst for Fox News and CNN, will join me with his thoughts. And at 42 past the hour, I'll talk big tech. Google fired a conservative Republican engineer after his posts on internal message boards. He claims that the atmosphere is heavily biased, not surprising, and has since filed claims with the National Labor Relations Board. Attorney Ron Coleman joins me with his thoughts on the matter. Just a reminder, visit our podcast website at tonyperkins.com, where you can find more information about our guests and our resources referenced today, and share the podcast with your friends. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins, or me if you care to, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, as Democrats continue to profess their undying animosity toward the racist, quote unquote, President Trump, his policies have been a huge blessing to the African American community. And in fact, since he took office, with passing tax cuts, negotiating trade deals, rebuilding the military, a booming unemployment rate, and fostering an economy that has taken off, the president is really making all parts of America greater. And not only is unemployment at historic lows, not only is the Dow at historic highs, but in May 2018, African-American unemployment hit a record low. Trump has helped create jobs and opportunities for the black community and has gotten the economy to work for all of us. Those are some of the words of my first guest, Ken Blackwell, who is FRC Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance. He served as domestic policy advisor to the Trump presidential transition team. Previously, he served as Ohio Secretary of State, Ohio Treasurer, and Mayor of Cincinnati. Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, Sarah. Good to be with you.
Ken, I am very passionate about this issue. And to give you a little bit of insight personally, my husband and I mentor a young woman and a young man who live south of 29th Street in Baltimore. I am a stone's throw from Baltimore City. In fact, when people ask me where I am from, I say just north of Baltimore. I worked for 7 years in inner city Baltimore. I know the city extremely well. And when I read President Trump's comments, the first thing I thought was good. He has called Representative Elijah Cummings to account because there are endemic issues of disparity, economic and otherwise, in inner city Baltimore. What we see on the media are the shiny facades of the inner city and North Charles Street, the charm of Hampden and the Baltimore Huns. But what no one wants to see is what West Baltimore looks like. And this young man who calls me his white mama, he says, I have two mamas, a black mama God gave me by birth and a white mama that chose me. And he said, Mama, I need some rat bait. Can you send it to my house? I teared up because I thought, this is a young man for whom Trump understands what is going on in the city. So let's talk about your op-ed. Let's talk about the city of Baltimore. And let's talk about what I think is a vast misperception about what is actually taking place in Baltimore. Do you think, based on where we are in the political landscape, that more blacks will vote for Trump in 2020 as opposed to 2016 as a result of what he's developed, this incredible track record of opportunity?
I do, Sarah. I think we will see a tick up in the number of African-American votes that the president receives. It won't be a dramatic uptick as things would have it, unfortunately, because, you know, the president's opponents are working overtime to advance a false narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only symptomatic of what we are witnessing. There is a real clash between the failures of an expanded welfare state versus the creation of a viable opportunity society. America is the shining city on the hill when we are distinctly different, when we in fact optimize individual liberty, reward hard work, and put a real harness on the growth and reach of government. The Great Society program started in the mid-60s, and we have spent trillions upon trillions upon trillions of dollars. And what we have experienced, like Baltimore, is the expansion of the number of people who have become more dependent on the federal government. And so I think, as opposed to taking a look at the failure of that expanded welfare state, the president's opponents would rather advance a false narrative that this president is racist when this president's policy agenda has in fact been transformative, not just for the country in general, but for those underserved citizens in our central and major urban areas.
So let me remind our listeners who may not be following this particular city as closely. We have had three Democratic mayors in a row resign in disgrace following very high-level scandals. So we have a real problem in Baltimore City, and yet we keep electing Democratic candidates, particularly in the city of Baltimore itself. It has been decades, as high as six decades, since we have had a Republican mayor of Baltimore City, and yet African-Americans keep voting for Democratic candidates. Have they bought the lie that the Democratic Party is the only party for them?
Well, I think what has happened is that they've become hooked on big government. You know, it started when I was a youngster. We didn't have what is now called the welfare system, which was a central part of the expanded welfare state. We had, for people who were trying to work their way out of a problem, we had relief, which was short term. And as a consequence of moving more and more towards this big government that was not only suffocating but addictive, taking away individual initiative, we are now escalating talk on the president, among the president's opponents, of a system where they will pay you for not working, even if in fact you're physically fit and able to work. I mean, that's part of an agenda.
Absolutely.
And so that's the problem. The president has gotten capital back into our economy. He's accelerated growth. Like I said, it's been transformative. Labor participation rate in the African-American community specifically, but across the board, has ticked up. Unemployment is down. Jobs are coming back. Manufacturing, something that past presidents basically said we would never be able to grow again in America, we're doing it. This president has done that. He's focused in on our military. He's in fact started to make sure that we're focused in on American interests first, and as a consequence, this president is now starting to challenge the status quo in our urban areas. And Ronald Reagan was fond of saying that the status quo is Latin for the mess that we're in. And this president is a disruptor of a failed status quo, and he doesn't really care about whose toes he steps on in trying to fix the problem.
I love that description. That's so precise and so accurate. This is a president that has passed historic criminal justice reform, the First Step Act, easing sentences for nonviolent criminals. He has promoted historically black colleges and universities. He has spurned economic investment into disadvantaged communities through opportunity zones that impact as many as a million minority households. But I want to talk now about what happened with Ben Carson. Ben, by the way, who was the head of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins University, which is in the heart of Baltimore City itself. So he understands this full well. What happened when he went out? This is an individual who is a Trump staffer, decides he wants to hold a presser on a couple of these different Baltimore and race-related issues, goes to hold the presser in the parking lot at Morningstar Baptist Church in Baltimore. And let's listen to what happened after they were kicked out.
We just have all this animosity all the time. For instance, you guys know you were set up on this property right here. It's a church. They say, get off of our property. A church, when we're talking about helping the people. I mean, this is the level to which we have sunken as a society. And it's so important that we stop this madness.
It's really unfortunate because this is an individual who worked in the city itself, who had worked himself up from poverty, who has a compelling story, who understands the black community, and yet they were kicked off the property of the church for making comments that just so happened to be supportive of the administration. Ken, what's your take on the story?
Look, the one thing I love about the president, and I respect in Dr. Carson, is that their voices for upliftment, their voices for restarting the society of the opportunity society in cities like Baltimore or L.A. or you name them, is that they will not be quiet. They will not be repressed. And one of the things that I tell Dr. Carson, other members of the cabinet who get what I call the bank shots, the ricochets of this attack on the president, is that dogs don't bark at parked cars. You know when the opposition is barking at you that you're on the move, you're doing the right thing.
Ken, I will unapologetically steal that from you, but I will make sure to give you attribution. Ken Blackwell has been my excellent guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, filling in today on this Friday edition for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, insanity out of Virginia. It has proposed regulations to punish and silence faith-based counselors who offer help to private patients wanting to overcome unwanted same-sex attraction. Plus, the Dems pass reparations for homosexuals in the House. I'll talk with FRC's Peter Sprigg coming up after the break.
Happy birthday to you.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday, dear.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
To Washington Watch, this is Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, filling in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition. TonyPerkins.com is the podcast website. As a reminder, find resources, links, and shareable options on our podcast site. Well, since the radical left has been trying and failing year after year in the Virginia legislature to silence counselors from sharing with clients the self-evident and biological realities of human identity and sexuality, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam is now eyeing an end run, alternate path through regulation to be able to accomplish this censorship through administrative regulation. Joining me now with his analysis is Peter Sprigg, FRC Senior Fellow for Policy Studies. Peter, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Okay, so this is an attempt by Governor Northam to do through regulation what the legislature specifically chose not to do. Now, it has to be noted that there are 18 states that have enacted bans through legislature on these so-called conversion therapy practices. And these are individuals coming for voluntary talk therapy. We need to clarify that.
Well, that's right. There's a lot of misconceptions about this therapy. And one of those, particularly with respect to these regulations or legislation that's targeted at the therapy for minors, is the suggestion that this is coerced, that somehow,
right,
you know, young people are being coerced into having this type of therapy against their will. Now, we do believe that parents have a right to decide the medical care for their children just as they would with any other medical care. But I can tell you, I know therapists who engage in this type of work, and they will not try to force someone to change against their will. That's just not the goal. The purpose of this therapy is for people who experience unwanted same-sex attractions. Having a motivation to change is obviously going to be a key in the success of any efforts like this, and so there's no point in offering it to people who don't want to change.
So let's talk specifically about the Commonwealth of Virginia. And it is a commonwealth, not a state, which is why I jokingly speak to my parents about how crazy the entire state is, because it's not actually a state. It's running its own show. If the homosexual lobby in this particular instance was being logical, they would not only celebrate the moment when someone declares that they are going to pursue homosexual attraction, but they would also cheer when someone chooses the happiness of going their own route that perhaps might lead to heterosexuality. If we want happiness in one way, we ought to want it in another way. Well, and yet...
And yeah, if we want freedom,
if we want freedom
and freedom of choice, then and freedom of people to pursue the living their own lives as they see fit, then you're exactly right. This is not for people who are happy being gay.
Correct.
This therapy is not for them. It is for people who experience their same-sex attractions as something unwanted.
Yes.
And it is about allowing them to exercise their personal autonomy, just like self-identified LGBT people want to exercise their personal autonomy. And you're right. It's a double standard, because they want freedom for their side, but not for people who have maybe a different viewpoint.
So the Virginia State Boards of Counseling, Psychology, and Social Work have started to adopt guidance documents and full-scale regulations. But the way in which these are worded, it really is nothing more than a speech ban, isn't it?
Well, this is a major concern that we have about this. Basically, you are interfering and this is something unprecedented. We have to understand how unprecedented this is. Never before in American legal history or in American psychological counseling history has the government attempted to interfere with a particular type of therapy based entirely upon the client-chosen goal mm-hmm. of the therapy. That there are certain goals that the client is not permitted to choose to pursue. That's what it boils down. Now, it's framed as a restriction on the therapist, but ultimately it's a restriction on the client. It's an interference with, first of all, the privacy of the relationship between therapist and client, which normally is sacrosanct, and it violates the what is normally a key ethical principle in the counseling profession, which is client autonomy, that the client sets the goals for therapy, not the therapist. But this is one goal. They're saying, nope, you're not allowed to set that goal.
Mm.
And it's really outrageous.
Well, and there's a particular hypocrisy here, because the regulations are worded as such that it is not only unwanted same-sex attraction, but it is also gender identity. Talk to me a little bit about the way it works as a ban against conservatives, but works as a promotion of the exact opposite.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you were right about the... about the freedom of speech issue. And we believe that this is a violation of free speech for the therapist. There are certain things that a therapist is not allowed to say to their client, basically, is what this boils down to. And the U.S. Supreme Court has sort of scoffed at last year at the idea that there is this category of professional speech that counts as conduct and is therefore not protected by the First Amendment. So I think there's good reason to believe the U.S. Supreme Court would strike down these regulations, and it's rather arrogant that they continue to pursue them. Now, on the gender identity issue, there is this irony that people are not allowed to, if they're unhappy with their same-sex attractions, they're not allowed to pursue change in sexual orientation. If they happen to be unhappy with their biological sex, they are encouraged to pursue radical transformation in their gender identity. It's only helping people to maintain maintain congruity with their biological sex that's illegal, but changing it is not.
No, it isn't. And in fact, we might see this at a Supreme Court level ultimately. We can close with the fact that just this week, the House Democrats unilaterally, by voice vote, passed a resolution essentially giving reparations for same-sex couples before DOMA was outlawed. Peter Sprague, our Senior Fellow for Policy Studies, has been my excellent guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch. Coming up next, the Navy SEALs seem to have a discipline problem and a culture problem. I'll be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, a Washington, D.C.-based broadcaster on national security. Coming up next. We'll be right back.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, the head of the U.S. Navy SEALs recently sent a scathing letter to top commanders in the unit, ordering them to detail issues with ethical behavior and conduct within the SEALs and find a way to fix them. CNN reported today that a letter sent by Rear Admiral Colin Green orders his officers to submit their reports by August 7th and states plainly that the SEALs have a problem. Joining me now with his analysis is Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis. He is a Washington, D.C.-based broadcast national security and foreign policy analyst for Fox and CNN. In addition, he serves as Family Research Council Vice President, and his books include Alliance of Evil, The Deeper State, and Never Submit. Will the Extermination of Christians Get Worse Before It Gets Better? Colonel, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, it's my pleasure, Sarah. Good to be with you.
Well, let's talk about the Navy SEALs, the elite fighting force that we have so come to love. We have a picture in our minds of who these individuals are, how hard they fight, how esteemed their work, how courageous. But it seems that there is an internal culture that commanders cannot seem to get a hold on. How bad is this discipline problem?
Well, it's hard to know from the outside. Clearly, the commanders have their internal reports. But keep in mind, Sarah, these people operate on the dark side of the world. In other words, we don't talk about what they do. Just like the takedown of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, you know, we didn't know about it until after the fact. And it's only, you know, through cursory reports that the, you know, leader of al-Qaeda was taken down and then shipped, you know, obviously to Kabul and then air transported to the USS Nimitz, which was in the Indian Sea, and then dumped. You know, those sorts of operations are really clandestine, and we don't talk about much of what they do. But given the counterinsurgencies and the counterterrorism operations across the world today, you know, no doubt our SEAL teams are very, very busy. And the job that they do is high risk. And so in a culture like that, where it's very secretive, it's reliance upon one another in very tense and desperate and dangerous situations, that often, if we're not careful, a culture will be developed where often if the leadership does not control it, things get out of hand. And that's why we've had a couple of trials of late. Clearly, the one with Specialist Warfare Chief Gallagher, which was in San Diego. We heard a lot about that in the national news. And, of course, he was exonerated for most everything, with the exception of course, appearing with a dead corpse. That's obviously unprofessional. But the aspect of what these people do, we typically do not talk about. But it would appear, based upon what Special Operations Command says and what Rear Admiral Colin Green has said, who was ultimately responsible for the entire SEAL team set, we've got a serious problem. And so he's going to have to dig into it. He's going to have to go after culprits and then try to turn that culture around in a way that it's professional, but it's also accountable to the American values that we expect of all our warriors.
So the letter didn't address specific incidents of poor conduct, but it came directly on the heels of an incident in which the entire SEAL Team 7 platoon was ordered home by superiors after a wild alcohol-fueled 4th of July party, ending in sexual assault accusations. So according to the Military Times, the Pentagon review that was originally done some time ago for Special Operations Command doesn't add up because it found essentially an all clear. So how could the Pentagon have missed these major problems as outlined here by Rear Admiral Green?
Well, it could be that the admiral sent them over to look at a very specific instance and didn't look at the broader cultural implications. You know, there are clearly issues with SEAL Team 7, SEAL Team 10, and others. And we've had, within the special operations community, we've had other incidents in the Green Berets and the Marine Raider organization elsewhere. Once again, in a culture where there's absolute trust and confidence in one another, and you have to exercise great discretion in your execution of your missions, that often people forget who they represent and what they're about. And it only takes a couple of rogue, professionals, former professionals, to do something offhand, or a leader to say something that gets out of hand. I used to be the chief for leadership at the infantry school, and would use the My Lai incidents with Lieutenant Cowie. That was a terrible atrocity during the Vietnam War, and we used it to illustrate how things can get out of hand. If the leader doesn't have a clear focus and communicate the requirements, then people, do things that are terribly offhanded, out of hand.
National security analyst and CNN commentator and former Family Research Council expert, Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, has been my guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony on the Friday edition. Coming up next, talk on big tech. Google fired yet another conservative Republican internal staffer, an engineer, who now says there was a lot of bullying going on and has filed claims with the National Labor Relations Board. More on tech censorship when attorney Ron Coleman joins me next on Washington Watch.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org /engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the garden tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. On this Friday edition, I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, Kevin Kernicke, who was still a Noogler. Now, this is the inside tech speak Google term for new employee. When his conservative take on political and social issues raised hackles within the search giant, it was within internal employee platforms that the red flags were raised. In just a moment, I'll talk about how this outspoken conservative in famously left-leaning Silicon Valley lost his job over these postings. Joining me now with his analysis is Ron Coleman, an attorney with whom I have dealt in other contexts on other issues. The man knows quite a bit about quite a bit. He practices commercial litigation at the New Jersey law firm of Mandelbaum Salzberg. He has been blogging on law since 2005 and has over 30,000 followers. Go follow him, at Ron Coleman. In 2017, he appeared before the Supreme Court, which resulted in a historic First Amendment ruling on behalf of the band, The Slants. Today, he represents social media figures Gavin McGinnis and Laura Loomer in litigation over their banning or deplatforming from social media. Ron, welcome to Washington Watch. I'm excited to have you.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah. It is absolutely my honor and privilege to be joining you.
So you understand this issue very intimately, and two of your clients are indeed dealing with this precise issue themselves. But let's go first to the case at hand, which is this Kevin Kernicke, who was relatively new as a Google employee, was flagged after several internal posts on the company's freewheeling internal message boards. And Google has professed that they want to generate a robust dialogue on issues sometimes controversial. But apparently his posts in early 2015 upset some of his Google coworkers. And at first blush, of course, it seems a little silly unless he was using violent or sexually inappropriate or racist language. But in this case, he was not. In fact, he was given an official warning from Human Resources about apparently his disrespectful and insubordinate postings, political in nature. And then something strange happened. A senior Google manager wrote on the boards that he had added Kevin to a written blacklist of employees he wouldn't want to work with, which to me seems pretty harsh and extreme. Is that your take on this, or am I being overly sensitive as a conservative who uses social media?
Well, it's the kind of thing that if someone were to publicize the fact that a list of left-wing or suspected communists who work within a company had been put on a management-approved or a manager's personal blacklist, the world would come to an end. Which is not to say that it's necessarily against the law, although in California it might be. But it is to say that there is a very serious problem with respect to toleration of opposing views if those opposing views are conservative. And these are not this particular employee, Kevin Kernke, not particularly out there. Evidently, he actually distanced himself somewhat from the relatively more outspoken James Damore.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't nearly enough, not at Google, according to his story. And Google hasn't done much to deny it.
So we are now in a situation where Mr. Kernke has left. He was fired in June 2018, and Google, of course, told him in a termination letter, predictably so, I would argue, that he was let go for multiple violations of company policies, which, of course, seems like a smokescreen to me, understanding how often and how loudly we are told about the fact that Google, as a particular platform, a subsidiary owned by Alphabet Inc., has proven to be problematic for unpopular political opinions. Kevin actually went on the record afterwards saying that there has been, a lot of bullying at Google, and it's almost as if they were ready with the tar and feathers, end quote. So Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy jumped in. Yesterday, he said that the allegations of political bias are troubling. And you and I both know no shortage of hearings on Capitol Hill on the notion of big tech censorship. And Sundar Pichai, who is Google's CEO, had earlier assured McCarthy that all viewpoints would be welcome. And McCarthy said, quote, time and again, we see actions that contradict free and open expression. End quote. So for me to have Sundar Pichai sit in front of a congressional committee and profess that there is no political bias, there is no viewpoint censorship, and yet to see the steady stream of ex-employees coming out of Google and the individuals raising the alarm on their own platform saying that they were banned for XYZ reason by a Google company. Do you think that Google has become perhaps internally more sensitive, a little easier to rankle since President Trump's election, understanding the bias in Silicon Valley?
Well, that's probably a pretty good bet. I think everyone on the left has become a lot easier to rankle because the presumption had been that history was on their side. And the ability of major institutions that considered themselves to be major contributors to the march of history was that they would not have any problem in handling that role. And I think one of the things that's interesting as a litigator is to hear Google take the position in public statements and in the case of its chairman under oath, that we're not doing this. It would be one thing if Google would say, as many of its supporters, both liberal and libertarian, say, look, it's a private company. They can have any culture they want to have.
Right.
If Google would come out and say that, just as if Twitter would come out and say, listen, I don't know what we were thinking, but let's start from scratch. Here are the people we're going to censor. Here are the kind of views we're not going to permit. Instead of pretending that terms of service or anything other than a pretext, that would be one thing. If Google would, again, come out and say, we're not interested in having an ideologically tolerant workplace, that would be one thing. But they are taking a public position, and again, they're even taking it under oath, that, no, we're not doing this. You're hearing from male contents. It's not really true what they allege. They were fired for plenty of good reasons, just as Twitter and the other social media platforms say, oh, no, these are terms. These people were disappeared and unpersoned because of terms of service violations,
right,
not because of the content of what they were saying.
So last week, another Google engineer, Gregory Coppola, gave interviews to a pair of conservative media outlets. And he also suggested that the company was politically biased toward the left. And we have a clip here. Let's listen.
We are seeing tech use its power to manipulate people. It's a time to decide, you know, do we run the technology? Does the technology run us? I really don't buy the idea that big tech is politically neutral, and I think we need to start incorporating that into whatever strategy we use. Are we going to continue to have elections that mean anything? Are we going to just let the biggest tech companies decide who wins every election from now on?
Well, I have to laugh because hours later, he received a call from HR at Google putting him on administrative leave and disabling his access to internal systems, thus proving the point that there is a problem in big tech. Because apparently, even though Google professes to tolerate and indeed encourage robust internal dialogue, they certainly don't want that type of dialogue repeated for others to hear it. So, Kevin, Gregory, their political stances are in the minority out in Silicon Valley. 95% of Google employee donations went to candidates in the 2018 midterms that were Democrats, according to Center for Responsive Politics. And I'm sure you are not surprised by those numbers, but understanding the left-wing bias, I want to switch a little bit to a broader perspective on the issue. And as someone who represents individuals who delight in shattering the status quo, a recent Federalist piece talked about why most conservative elites ignore concerns about free speech. Now, these are not the internal engineers. They are not the old ladies who are knitting things and they happen to be Trump imagery and are thereby banned through a knitting forum, or individuals who make a particular comment on Reddit in their own personal capacity. We are talking conservative elitism here. They are disinclined to get involved, even though it looks like there are two options for this. We legally protect free speech. We have to take action from a regulatory standpoint, much as I, as a free market conservative, am pained to utter those words. But second, people need alternative platforms that actually allow for free speech and equal access to users. So here we have two options for a solution, and yet neither of those solutions have been employed. What do you think that is owing to?
Well, I think the article that you're referring to in the Federalist, brings up some very, very good points. And he says, look, the system works for those who have already made it big, whether they're on the right or otherwise. In fact, to some extent, it behooves people who are sort of stakeholders in the commentariat on the right to watch, to have the left do for it the job of censoring their competitors. And he makes the point, about existing, you know, the power of existing systems. And I just, you know, you had said something in your introduction to the question about the free market. The state of play right now has very little to do with the free market.
Mm-hmm.
There is not really a free market for social media services. And he makes the point in his article, August Mayrat, about the idea that it's extremely difficult to start a new social media platform. He doesn't really write at length about it, but there's something called network effects, which make it extremely difficult in an interconnected, sort of technological and economic ecology that now exists, as it does in many other fields, for a startup to get in. That's what the antitrust laws were meant to deal with, although not necessarily in those terms. I think there's another reason that he does address in his, that does not address in his article, which is very important and that we have to be very conscious of, which is that because there's a process by which the left identifies targets that are increasingly less extreme over time, mm-hmm. people are terrified by being by defending or advocating for those who have been deplatformed, because then in the facile analysis, so the facile name-calling, it passes for analysis on the internet. Those people are then deemed as having adopted all the viewpoints
right.
of the people they are defending, or whose right to speak they are defending, and that's Steve Crowder, who is no right-winger, experienced this. David Rubin, not a right-winger. Tim Pool, not a right-winger. I don't think they've given up trying to get rid of Tucker Carlson, but Tucker Carlson is a very conservative thinker, but he is no member of the alt-right.
Right.
So there is a certain amount of fear among those who might be inclined to stick their necks out to stand up for the rights of a Gavin McInnes or a Laura Loomer, to find themselves immediately asking, oh, in other words, you think it's okay that Gavin McInnes did X, or you think it's okay that that Laura Loomer said Y.
The guilt by association argument.
Well, not only guilt by association, they will pick the most egregious thing that person ever said or did. And that is deemed to be the entire body of work and human worth of that person.
Right. So,
you know, there are people who have, you know, stepped on certain third rails of social and cultural life in our times who are considered essentially to be irredeemable by virtue of having uttered the wrong word at the wrong time as conservatives. On the other hand, as a liberal, forgiveness is eternal. Have they ever convinced Al Franken to take one for the team, given that liberals are actually never called to account? That was obviously a tactical move, on the part of the Senate, of the Democrats in the Senate. It's amazing to me, but that's where we are.
Well, and we stand on the precipice of perhaps consideration if it can garner some momentum of Senator Josh Hawley's ending support for Internet Censorship Act, about which I am hopeful, but for which he cannot seem to garner any momentum. And so, once again, we find sort of a self-perpetuating problem. So we will be following it and your cases as well. Ron Coleman has been my excellent guest. He is an attorney with Mandelbaum Salzburg, a commentator, and an individual who knows quite a bit about quite a bit. Follow him on Twitter at Ron Coleman. This has been Washington Watch. I'm your host, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast site. Tony at T. Perkins. Me at Sarah P. Perry. We'll catch you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.